Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 146 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and I've got three co-hosts with me. First up, David Vanderhoof from the Just What... the third week in a row.
Hi, folks. It's David from the Just WhatJustFlewBy.com blog, and now Max has got me mixing it up.
Oh, what a great start. All right, let's try this. This one should be easier. Next is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for listening. Boy, golly, I'm sure excited for the show today, Rob. How about you?
Well, golly gosh.
Oh, man, we're devolving. All right, so that's Rob Mark from the Jetwine blog. Hi, Rob.
Wow. Here we are in Chicago waiting for spring still. I mean, and of course, with the guy on from Ice Pilots, I mean, of course, I'm embarrassed to say that we're a little chilly here in Chicago. I mean, I can't imagine what the temperature is up there.
Even before I knew who our guest was this week, for the past couple of months on my iPhone, on the weather app, I have Yellowknife on there during the winter, so that way I can be like, well, I really shouldn't complain.
That's dedication. Very good. Well, we should tell folks that our guest this episode is Mikey McBrien from Buffalo Airways in the TV show Ice Pilots NWT. We've got a great conversation with Mikey coming up. You're really going to enjoy this. Mikey's quite a character. Buffalo Airways is quite an interesting operation, and the TV show Ice Pilots is fantastic. First, though, we've got the week's aviation news. David is going to give us a little bit of aviation history with his This Week in Aviation segment. As always, we have Stephen Grant with their Australia Desk Report. Peter Johnson has his Across the Pond segment on European aviation. And we ought to have time for a little bit of listener mail.
So, and I believe Rob has some aviation haikus this week.
Is that anything like any...
Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, is that anything aviation haikus? Are those anything like aviation high fives?
Oh, my God. You shouldn't have stopped, Max. Just keep going.
Okay, sorry.
First story comes from Aviation Week. Bin Laden raid may have exposed stealth helo. Bill Sweetman writes, a previously undisclosed classified stealth helicopter apparently was part of the U.S. task force that killed Osama bin Laden in Pakistan on May 1st. It appears to be a highly modified version of an H-60 Black Hawk. So probably everybody's familiar with the news and knows that there was a two-helicopter mission. One of the helicopters experienced some kind of difficulties and had to be abandoned, and was blown up in the compound where Osama bin Laden was holding out. But it appears from some of the photographs that this might have been a fairly interesting helicopter, David.
It's a very interesting helicopter, and surprisingly, no one really knew about it. What it is a modified H-60, the colloquial Sikorsky product that just about everybody and their brother flies anymore. But it was modified with a faceted fuselage. What does that mean? A faceted fuselage means that if you remember the good old F-117 and all of those funky flat panels all over it, well, add that to a helicopter.
Wow.
The Army has been experimenting with quieting a helicopter for years now. They've always used... if you watch Black Hawk Down, the website they use, the helicopters they use are H-60s. They also use something called an AH-6 Little Bird, which is a McDonnell Douglas MD-500 or OH-6. And they're very quiet because they have five or six rotor blades and as many tail rotors. 90% of the noise from a helicopter comes from the tail rotor. If anyone has been next to a Huey when it's going, two rotor blades going boom, 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 makes a lot of noise. This tail rotor had, and what you can see left over hanging over that fence, is you get a five-bladed tail rotor. Normally, a H-60 has a four-bladed tail rotor. It also has a disc mounted on it, which acts as suppression for radar, because a big whirling blade gives off a big radar section, especially the large metal that are attached to the blades, and it also helps to quiet it. If anyone has looked closely at an F-22 or the new V-22 Ospreys, they both have this kind of metallic, kind of shiny, kind of glossy but not glossy, funky finish to them.
It's some kind of coating or something?
The F-16s also got them. It was a program called Have Glass, which is a film slash coating that they put over normal paint finishes to make them more radar absorbent so that the radar beams don't back. So what you get is you get a faceted helicopter that's got a hush kit on it, and then you add this paint on top of those facets. And people have been saying things like, it sounds like the helicopter's going away when it's coming towards you. And there's a lot of funky technology that were in those H-60s. And unfortunately, what happened was, as the helicopter came over the fence, it lost ground lift because it was coming down too fast and did a hard landing and hit the fence and broke in half. So they had to blow it up. Unfortunately, there was still a lot left, and it's not a good sight when your top secret technology has been taken away back home by little kids in large chunks. I'm sure the Pakistanis will dispose of it, but eventually I'm sure that the Chinese will have a look at it before that happens. So you can probably assume that the technology is about 10 years old. So it's not state of the art, but it's now out of the dark.
Right.
So that's the big issue.
And there's probably lots of other things in aviation these days that we don't know about that represent, you know, things like this that, you know, will come out later in the future. I mean, there's always black programs, right?
Yeah, there's always black programs. Ironically, these supposedly were stored out in Nevada, which everyone knows, especially if they're Doctor Who fans, is Area 51, and go from there. So let it be said that the United States military is not sitting on their laurels and they're pushing ahead with technology like they always have. It just only occasionally comes out into the light.
Well, Boeing is also pushing ahead with technology, and we see in Daily Tech that Boeing completes first test flight of a Phantom Ray stealth UAV. This is kind of an interesting looking aircraft. It kind of reminds me of the B-2 bomber. The article says that this was Boeing first unveiled a near complete version of its Phantom Ray unmanned aerial vehicle nearly a year ago. But just this past week, Boeing announced that its Phantom Ray had completed its first flight. Now, interestingly enough, at least to me, this program, according to the article, is being funded completely by Boeing. I guess there's no military funding going on for this.
It's a proof of concept vehicle. The Phantom Ray is to show that autonomous UAVs can perform strike missions. And what you have with the Phantom Ray is you have something roughly the size of an FAA-18 that has all of the capabilities of an FAA-18 and without a pilot. So that's where the technology is going. UAVs for reconnaissance, we've gotten used to. We've gotten used to UAVs with Hellfires taking out encampments, and now we're going to have UAVs dropping 2,000-pound JDAMs on people and then returning base autonomously. So the future is coming, folks.
I also noted that it's powered by the F-404 engine, which, of course, is what powers the F-18. Next story comes from the Charlotte Observer. Merger talk still simmers at U.S. Airways. The CEO of U.S. Airways, Doug Parker, has been making some comments about the future of that airline and whether it may merge or combine with another airline. Dan, what do you think about this one?
Always good to start off my things with an By the way, before I get started, I'd like to make a comment, and I know I'm going to be the human speed bump for this episode of the podcast, but
so far,
can we go through one episode without mentioning Doctor Who sometime?
Well, so far we've been doing that this one, but I guess we've blown it now, huh?
Anyway, there's been a lot of media coverage for months and months about U.S. Airways and consolidation. And actually, really, I don't think there's anything really new lately. I mean, U.S. Airways has been open to consolidation for a while. If you recall, I can't believe it's a year ago now, But a year ago, there were merger talks between U.S. Airways and United, and that didn't work out. And actually, back in 2001, there was a potential merger between United and U.S. Airways. That didn't pan out. Obviously, they merged with America West a few years ago, and also there's an attempt for U.S. Airways to make a bid for Delta back in the day, which didn't work out. So U.S. Airways has been an advocate for consolidation. But if you go into the article, I mean, Doug Parker really doesn't say anything new. The key quote I found is there is one big deal left, and that's with U.S. Airways, Parker said last month. I believe any of the three, and he means the three major carriers, at the right time could do something with us if we wanted to and they wanted to. So it's basically U.S. Airways is just open to consolidation, but I think they've just been a supporter of it overall. I mean, I'm looking at the press release from a year ago when they said the discussions with United had ended, and they said Doug Parker said at the time, quote, it remains our belief that consolidation makes sense in an industry as fragmented as ours. Whether we participate or not, consolidation that leads to a more efficient industry, better able to withstand economic volatility, global competition, and the cyclical nature of our industry is a positive outcome, unquote. So basically, they're open to a deal, but, you know, nothing really new here.
And we have some news about...
What? What?
Oh, see what God. You started, Dan.
I'm sorry.
That's your fault. I call
sorry
it your
I
fault,
Dan. The Doctor Who gods.
David?
I missed it. What did I miss?
Oh, God. Yeah. All right. Sorry.
We have an article from Air Transport World. Republic narrows loss, but struggles continue at Frontier. Republic Airways Holdings had a loss for the first quarter. It wasn't as big as the loss for the first quarter a year ago, but it's still $22.4 million compared to $36.5 million loss a year ago.
Well, it's just been very interesting to follow the whole Frontier story because a couple years ago we saw a Frontier was in tough financial shape at the time, and Southwest made an attempt to acquire them, but Republic ended up winning there. And it's just very interesting to watch just because Republic, before they acquired Frontier and also Midwest Airlines, they were basically a holding company for multiple subsidiaries that were regional airlines operating service for mainline carriers under brand names like U.S. Airways Express, Delta Connection, and so forth. But now they have these two sides of the business. So it's been very interesting to watch it develop, especially as in their two hubs that they've acquired, Milwaukee and Denver, they both are very competitive. So it looks like they still have some challenges. The key paragraph I found in this article was, quote, Republic's challenges continue to center on Frontier. Although revenues rose 12.2% to $395.4 million, branded flying had a pre-tax loss of $55.2 million, reduced from $70.4 million last year. Excluding special items, the 2011 pre-tax loss with $51.2 million widened from $42.3 million in 2010. So they certainly have challenges. Like any other airline, they're facing, as I mentioned, they have competitive markets. They also, every airline has faced increased fuel costs. I mean, fuel has been, the oil market has been incredibly volatile over the past week even. I mean, we've seen big increases in oil price driven by multiple factors, including, you know, unrest in the Middle East. But I mean, this week we saw crude oil, at least we saw crude oil go down significantly over the past week. So. Lots of interesting stuff going on. And also, I just want to clarify and magnify one thing we talked about last week. They're removing the E-170 service, the Embraer 170 from the Frontier operation. As we talked about last week, they've announced a new deal with Delta recently. Will it be transferring more E-170s to the Delta Connection operation? So that's 14 E-170s. According to this article, the other three Embraer 170s will be going to other regional operations later this year that they didn't specify. So, you know, it's very interesting to watch Frontier and specifically Republic develop the Frontier operations. So it'll be interesting to see the adjustments they're making as they remove these aircraft.
Republic recently had a earnings call where there was an interesting statement about a placeholder deposit.
Yes. This is an article from Flight Global, and this article mentions a quote, a placeholder deposit on Airbus Neo aircraft. So there really wasn't much expansion on this. it doesn't appear that there's been any official order made at this point. So, but it certainly looks like Republic is interested in the Neo, at least according to this article, which makes me very interested because Republic is also one of the few customers for Bombardier C-Series. So depending on, you know, how this all plays out, if we see Republic eventually making some kind of move for the A320 Neo, I mean, traditionally, we've seen a lot of press about how viewing the A320 Neo and the C series as a competitor, which, you know, I think is certainly true. But depending how this plays out, there could be an interesting case for how the two aircraft can coexist in one airline's fleet. This will be fun to watch.
All right. Well, you know, it seems like air traffic control can't stay out of the news, and we see an example of that in the from the Houston Chronicle. Houston computer glitch, another blow to FAA. And it seems that there was a glitch, a 90-minute glitch, according to this article, halted and delayed air traffic across central and southeast Texas. Rob, is this typical? I mean, do we usually have computer glitches that knock out air traffic control for an hour and a half?
Oh, it happens, unfortunately. The real problem is that most people don't really know how antiquated some of the equipment still is. I mean, you know, FAA went through an awful lot of work not that many years ago, maybe even a decade ago, talking about all the upgrades they'd made. But they were coming out of the vacuum tube era. And so, wow. Yes, in that sense, yes, it was a marvelous change. But in general, I mean, the technology at FAA is not keeping up with the rest of the state of the art. And you know what? Stuff breaks. I mean, it just breaks. And it also shows you that the system is just not the pieces of the system are very, very interdependent upon each other.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the technology fails, it goes to hell in a handbasket. And in the old days when you had controllers that could work what they called non-radar, or they knew what to do. They'd seen that so many times that they could practically do it in their sleep. The new controllers don't have that kind of experience. And it's not bad. It's just that, you know, they just don't have that to fall back on. So the whole system kind of comes to a grinding halt.
Our guest this episode is Mikey McBrien from Buffalo Airways and the TV show Ice Pilots NWT. Mikey, welcome to the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Well, thanks for having us on here, or having me on here.
Well, it's a real pleasure. So, Mikey, how do you think about yourself as a TV star?
Well, that's in the recent, you know, few months, that's one of the most popular questions I get. But usually, a kid that grew up in a town of 3,600, and that was the second largest town in the territory where I'm from. It's a pretty small town, so everyone knew each other anyway. So it's, I don't know, it's, we're just same old as we were before.
Just regular guys.
Yeah.
So tell us, what does Buffalo Airways do? What's your business?
Well, Buffalo Airways is basically just your regular airline, except that we just don't do it how regular airlines do it. up where we are, there's no roads. So, you know, most airlines operate between places that have roads. So you're moving passengers and very time-sensitive stuff. We don't have the luxury of that up here. So basically the aircraft run as the road. You know, ice roads only last, you know, maybe 60 to 90 days. So the 365 days of the year that aren't, or whatever is left, has to be flown in. So we basically move everything by air.
Now, when you say, you know, up there, you're talking about, you're based in Yellowknife, is that correct? Yellowknife, Canada?
Yeah, we're based at Yellowknife Northwest Territories, which is the capital of our territory. You know, Canada's a little bit different. We got provinces and territories. Basically, which means we really can't support ourselves. You know, we need federal assistance. So we are twice the size of Texas with only 40,000 people.
Oh, wow. Boy, that puts it in perspective.
So we're basically an outpost of Canada.
Now, you pick up and deliver, I mean, all kinds of cargo, including generators I saw in one of the recent episodes.
Yeah, everything. Like I was saying before, if it doesn't fly in to a lot of these communities, they don't get it. Generators, you know, fully loaded, you know, airplanes full of potato chips. You know, you can imagine it. We have a DC-4 that came in the Yellowknife because we're actually isolated right now because of a ferry system's out between seasons. And it was, you know, DC-4 can haul 20,000 pounds. We got 10,000 pounds of potato chips, and basically the thing was stuffed full.
Wow. Now what's in the fleet besides the DC-4? You've got some pretty interesting aircraft.
The funny thing is, for me to even check it out, I go to Wikipedia. Wikipedia, I think, says we're up to like 49 now, but realistically, I think it's really about 55. There's just crazy. From the smallest, Fleet Canucks, 185, Norseman, Douglas DC-3, DC-4, Curtis C-46, Canadair CL-215 water bombers. What else? Beach Barons, King Airs, Travel Airs. We even have Vampire Fighter Jet.
You do? What do you do with that?
The old man got it in some horse trading deal, sent it to the museum.
Oh.
And then, you know, Rocket Champs, just insane. Everywhere you look, there's way more airplanes than there is pilots.
I mean, those are some pretty historic aircraft you've got there. Do you see them as historic aircraft or just, you know, kind of tools of the business?
Well, very, very recently, I began to start to appreciate the historic. At the pinnacle would be the, you know, Oshkosh last year, where we went down for the 75th right. birthday of the DC-3. We have 13 DC-3s, and I literally grew up around those aircraft. My father started flying them on his daily passenger sked, the last one in the world with DC-3, in 1982, the year I was born. So, you know, I'm 28 now, turned 29, and it's really been there every single day of my life. Like, I at least fly on it 3 times a week. So it's crazy normal to me. And I thought everyone was like this up until, you know, just recently where I realized it was all changed.
Now, I mean, where do these airplanes come from? I mean, these are some really fantastic airplanes. Where do you get these things?
Well, of course, they're all originally American military.
Sure.
And the Canadian military acquired them. And then they go up for surplus. So, like, all of them have, you know, 15, 20 different owners throughout the years. The DC-4s, you know, a lot of them, you know, one of them there has been in the Berlin Airlift. One of them carried over the polio monkeys from Australia. Wow. Just yeah. insane. Like, Normandy, D-Day, like, all these histories, like, that none of us at Buffalo can ever remember, like, which airplane did which, but the you know, just massive amounts of people from Europe come over just to study the serial numbers. They basically go and say, hey, WIR, which we're like, we got our airplanes are, you know, got letters and not like N numbers. And so like WIR serial number, blah, 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 was, you know, it was in the 11th wave of Normandy. And they were like, oh, really? That's pretty cool. It's Toledo right now with a load of soda pop.
I see Rob has joined us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, good evening. I'm really sorry I'm late. It was one of those Mother's Day, you know, requirements. What can I tell you? Well, Mickey, I'm really excited. I'm sorry I missed the first part of the show. I'm going to go back and have to listen to it a little bit. But we're just so glad you were able to join us. I mean, I was watching some of the episodes on the links that you'd sent, and I realized I had been watching them anyway. I just hadn't put all the names together. So how do you stay warm up there?
Being born and raised up here really, really helps. You know, it's all about layers and stuff like that. But the funny thing is we're opposite, where we can't handle the heat at all. Like yeah. I went to Dominican Republic and I stayed in the hotel room the entire time because I couldn't go outside.
Oh, God.
Well, how about the machinery? How about the planes? And what can you tell us about what it's like to operate a fleet like that in such cold weather? And how cold does it get up there?
The coldest it usually gets would be minus 40 Celsius, which is the same as Fahrenheit. It gets a little bit colder than that, but very, very 40 is usually where it will stay. That's kind of like a weird magic number where it stays, and then it dips down, you know, to extremities, another maybe minus 50 degrees Celsius on the extreme stream end.
Wow.
But at that temperature, you know, water just basically vaporizes in the air, and you get this weird kind of ice fog because there's absolutely like the moisture in the air is really leaving. So once you get that cold, it kind of stabilizes. But the airplanes, these airplanes really started coming up north during the dew line era. You know, the distant early, you know, when we were thinking the Russians were going to take a shortcut over Canada.
Yep.
So those airplanes, that's the first real, what really opened up the north. You know, DC-3, C-46s were way more common than vehicles. So they just decided to stay when they were done. They worked out so well.
And those old radials start up okay in that cold weather?
Yeah, you got to, you got to have a, an 18 to 25 year old kid that's got enough energy to make sure that they don't freeze up. But we use engine tents, multiple engine tents, with ceramic heaters and probe heaters in the oil. And, Herman Nelsons or frost fighters, which are diesel or gas fired heater blowers that blow in hot air.
Mm-hmm.
And you just keep on going. You keep that oil warm, and then she fires up. And once it's fired up, she loves those cold temperatures because the performance goes nuts.
How about maintenance in general? I mean, these are, 50, 60-year-old airplanes in some cases. What about spare parts and all that?
Well, that's part of the fun of it. We can't just call up Boeing and say, hey, can you send your Douglas rep to bring us a prop hub?
Yeah.
It's really that adds to the fun of the job because it's not really a job for us. It's really like a lifestyle, just like how you'd say to a biker gang member and saying, well, how do you like working for the Hells Angels? And you don't really, you kind of live there. And that's how we do it here, where a lot of us are family members or, adopted because they stayed so long and you really got to go hunting. I was very fortunate to, grow up my entire childhood at least once or twice a year going into the States with my father searching for parts during like auction sales and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And we got massive amounts of parts in Red Deer, Alberta. We have easily the world's largest supply of DC-4, DC-3, C-46, Catalina Cansos in the world for parts. Like I'm talking football fields would not be able to contain the boxes.
Wow.
It's just absolutely insane. All bought for pennies on the pound because of companies going under. Now, like when I was growing up, so we're talking mid-90s, and then the early 2000s, there was lots. There was, at least there used to be two auctions a year, but Starman Auctions in the States there. Used to be two major auctions a year, and then there was one. Now there hasn't been once for about 5 years, so it's recently just dried up. And my father knew that this day was coming, so we're basically, made a bomb shelter of DC-3 parts.
Huh, interesting. Now, you mentioned your father. That's Buffalo Joe, right?
Yeah, that's he's the head dictator of the whole operation. He started Buffalo May 1970 because he couldn't work for anybody. So he decided to work for himself. And then he basically does everything he can possibly do so he can fly his DC-3 every day.
Now, I saw an episode where you describe him as being sort of a mixture of three people put together. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I think I said, what did I say?
What was Al Bundy?
Al Bundy from, because he's got this comedic side that you don't get to see on the show because he only does it kind of after hours. And he is, well, it kind of looks like Al Bundy, and then Howard Hughes, Howard Hughes didn't really listen to anybody. He just did what he wanted and made it work.
Right.
He's got a little bit of that. And James Dean probably, cause he's, my dad's got a 49 Merc, the exact replica of James Dean.
Nice.
He's probably got 30 or 40 Mercury vehicles, all 50s era because he just really hasn't grown up.
Sounds like a fun guy.
It's funny. I was watching one of the episodes. I can't remember which one it was, and I don't know who the young lady was that they panned on at one point. She said, "I wouldn't want him mad at me." I don't know who that was, but
yeah,
there's so many different versions of him. The television show really catches only one side, only because he's really annoyed by cameras. So sometimes when he seems grumpy. He's really grumpy because there's a camera in his face and he doesn't really want to talk to him.
Well, did you guys already talk before I got here about how this whole show got started?
No, not yet. In fact, that's kind of the next topic. Mikey, how did it come about?
Yeah, Mikey, how did it come about?
Well,
nice work. Great idea, Max.
Yeah, good job, Rob. I know I can count on you.
Yeah.
It was really a one in a million type thing. A little background was I started off, my father out of the whole family is the only pilot in the whole family, which is which no one really realized up until people started asking the question. So we all do different things. My brother's a director of maintenance. My sister's in PR. My mom's an accountant. My uncle Ronnie specializes in aircraft recovery. My nephew Kenny is getting back into accounting. So we all do a different job. No one does the other person's job. So I was trying to be a mechanic, but I just wasn't very good.
Wait a minute. How did you know you weren't a very good mechanic, or should we ask?
Because I couldn't fix anything. I always had to get my brother to fix it. So my brother got all the mechanical genes. What I found out what I was good at was organization, basically figuring out how to get trips done and how to organize and, you know, keep everything going. So I decided to go to business school a little bit late. I know going to college was more of a vacation for me because we were just working so much. But when I was in college, you know, I got all my diplomas and everything in marketing. And I just got a call one day from a producer out of Vancouver trying to get a hold of my father because he read an article in one of the national papers in Canada about these European guys coming over, calling themselves prop heads, coming over and just researching serial numbers and everything and like doing all the history of the airplanes. And the guy turned out to be a DC-3 fan, and he said, geez, this is going to make a perfect reality show. Of course, my father would not return his call. So someone basically said, well, I might as well just call Mikey. He'll listen. David Ellison phoned me up. I was in Red Deer going to college, and he said, hey, do you want to be on TV? And I said, sure. Yeah, that sounds like fun.
Yeah.
So I got all the newspaper clippings I could find, put them in a backpack. I jumped on a 737, and I flew down to Vancouver to their office, and I threw it all on the table. I said, what kind of stories do you want to film? And they basically said, let's film everything. And I said, well, before I get into this, like, what's the chances of this happening? And he's like, well, we're interested, so probably maybe 10%. And yeah, that was 2007. And it took about a year for them to get enough funding. And then finally they got some money. We did a pilot episode, which actually part of it is that generator one with the DC-4.
Trying to get it to fit on the plane, right?
Yeah. And so that shot it, we did it. And then they took it to, like in the States there, you guys got History Channel. In Canada, it's called History Television. And we went there and basically showed the vice president. And the vice president said, yeah, not only will we'll buy it, we'll do, you know, 13 episodes, which was unheard of.
Fantastic. For
a Canadian show. Yeah. And then once it aired, it broke their records for, you know, a Canadian made documentary series, second only to Ice Road Truckers, which is on the same channel.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In Canada. So they stood up and took notice. So they ordered season two right away, and then season two started airing, and then, you know, they liked it. So we're shooting season three right now, and next month we'll know if they want a season four.
That's fantastic. You know, one of the things, Mikey, is, I mean, to be quite honest with you, I'm not a huge fan of reality TV shows because a lot of them just don't seem very real. They seem kind of contrived. But when I watch Ice Pilots, I don't get that feeling at all. I feel like I'm not only am I watching real stuff, but it's just real cool stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of, before I got into this, I really sat down, because being in college, you got some free time. Like if you weren't at the bar, I was at home, you know, trying to watch every single reality show I could to see how they did it. And the one thing I noticed with other reality shows, especially the ones that don't involve people working, it seems super fake once you know how it all works.
Yeah.
You know, like how would they even be in that situation? Right. Doesn't even make sense. And stuff like that. So I took notice of that. And then and then when we got there, of course, the first day they show up, they got a camera guy, a director, a sound man, and a producer, like a four-man kind of like spider, like tarantula walking around the hangar as a group.
Yeah.
And immediately we knew that wasn't going to work because with the airplanes, we can maybe fit one person on. So they moved into basically a one-man band, what they call it, is basically one guy with a camera does everything. And so he what that does is he doesn't have the luxury to, you know, create situations. He's basically running around like with a chicken with his head cut off, trying to get everything on film. So he's catching it, you know.
It's spontaneous.
More spontaneous. If he misses it, he misses it. So he's basically shooting as much as he can and doing it like in an airplane with an engine problem. Like these camera guys are crazier than we are because they don't know what's going on, and yet they still go every day. What that does, though, it really, the footage that you get is, I would say, on an honest thing, I would say it's probably 90% exactly perfect.
Wow.
And the only the 10% that isn't is, you know, when you watch a show, we're not, you know, flying around with three airplanes shooting air to air. So they use footage here and there, you know, different air shots and stuff like that, just because it'd be just crazy to have three airplanes flying around.
Sure.
Sometimes the narration's off because just the way they describe things. But when you physically see is 100% accurate.
That's up great. Until
that's like there's no we don't there's nothing really made up or I wouldn't say overhype, but hype for no reason.
Yeah.
Like it's really, really legitimate, and I think that's what really cuts it through is
yeah, that's how it comes across.
What airline would actually let you get in there? Because, you know, airline, like, you know, the aviation industry is so, you know, it's really, you know, everyone wants to portray themselves as being absolutely perfect because that's how it is. I don't think anyone but Buffalo would allow to show the, you know, the steamy underside of how it actually is.
Hmm.
So did they do any scripting at all? I mean, do they just say, you know, what we really need you guys to do is maybe kind of, you know, go off in this direction or not go, or is it just absolutely whatever you guys do, they just follow you around?
That's it. You know, in Canada here, they have really, really, really stringent rules. You know, Canada, the market, like we're like easily 1/10 of the viewership that you would have there in the States. So it's very expensive to make a show like this. And it's evident, they're audited pretty heavily. And they're actually not allowed to create situations, or they can lose their funding.
That's interesting. Yeah,
it's a really weird thing. So there isn't any scripting at all. Like it's harder to do it that way because you actually have to think. This way, the cameras show up and you don't think; you just do what you want to do.
Hmm.
Wow. Do you think there'd be a role for somebody like Dan if we were to send him up there with you guys for a month or?
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll take anybody that's willing to work.
Oh, well, so much for that idea.
Yeah, that leaves
Dan. Wow.
Thank you. Oh, boom, boom. Oh, my God. This is when we... Sorry.
On the other hand, I'll be perfectly happy to lift boxes if it'll get me a ride in a C-46.
Yeah.
The one thing, actually, my brother is very hesitant with the cameras, but the one thing he's very happy about is you know, try to find a C-46 in any other format. It's the most unfilmed airplane in history. Like even Air America, which was all C-46s, they used the provider, like in the movie.
It's the unsung hero of World War II.
For sure. I mean, you know what?
It's the unglamorous DC-3.
Exactly. Like, the thing is a beast. Like I just love flying in it. You know, you got two R-2800s, you know, 5 feet from your face, both sides, screaming 2,000 horsepower down a 3,000-foot strip, and you got 14,000 pounds on board, and you got a, you know, you got a 25-year-old captain. This is some fun stuff. I wouldn't trade it for the world. You know, the airplane hauls over twice as much as the DC-3, and has the exact same operating cost, meaning. The reason why it was such a successful drug runner is because it made perfect economical sense.
Huh.
And Mikey, how did they shoot the episodes that I've seen? My favorite shots are those head-on shots as they're coming down the runway. You have the camera sitting there, and the DC-3 just basically retracts its. I mean, the DC-4 retracts its gear off the end of the off of the runway, and it comes head-on to you. Those are amazing shots.
Oh yeah, like the film crew puts their cameras in all sorts of crazy situations. And you could see one of the shots there. I don't want to ruin it. Was it season one or season one here? You're going to get a shot of an airplane, you know, not landing properly. And the cameraman's on the end of the runway. And it's one of the rare moments in the show where, you know, the camera's designed to be, you know, the camera and the crew are designed to be, you know, invisible. But this landing situation here, you could really see the camera guy jumping out of the way and grabbing his camera and, you know, bleeping, bleep, bleep, what the bleep. So, they basically just put the camera wherever and tell the pilot, please don't hit it.
Very cool. Well, let's mention before we get too far that people can find more about ICE Pilots at the website, right? Icepilots.com.
Yeah, you got the icepilots.com, but they also got the natgeotv.com, which is going to be geared a little bit towards you guys, because it is a little bit different. You know, ICE Pilots don't want to ruin too much because we are. In our second season here in Canada, but you guys want to keep it real, you stick with the Nat Geo site and you get all your info right there.
That's great. I think that's channel.nationalgeographic.com, and you can find Ice Pilots on there.
Mm-hmm.
And you guys are also on Twitter, I think.
The Twitter and the Facebook, and every Friday they have a caption contest where we put up a picture, and then people, whoever gets the best caption, they send them free Buffalo stuff, which is kind of cool. And yeah, there's a huge Facebook following and all that stuff. That's really fun. We keep that up. We totally try to react with all the fans, you know, because we're really the underdog TV show. And so any time a fan comes in the hangar, there's like or phones us or sends us a message, we try our best to answer them.
That's great. That's fantastic.
And you guys are on Twitter, you're the Ice Pilots NWT, I think, right?
Yes.
All right. Yeah, so for those listeners that are going to watch, in fact, I just realized I'm not following you guys, but I'm going to fix that. There you go.
And the NWT is for Northwest Territories,
right?
Right.
Yeah, that's where we are.
So do you guys want to do a quick maybe speed round of word association with Mikey? Are you guys up for that?
Oh, no.
Yeah, this is the part where we never tell our guests in advance, but what we do is we'll each flip out a word or a phrase, and then you just start talking about whatever pops into your mind. How's that?
Yeah, sounds good.
All right, does someone want to start, or you want me to go?
I'll start.
Okay, David.
Radial engine.
Beautiful music.
Yeah.
That bird right there, it's just, when you got a radial engine, it's the sound. The sound is just awesome. I can't imagine not having an airplane without a radial engine.
That's cool. Rob, do you have a word?
You know me. I never seem to be able to do a single word. So you'll have to bear with me, Mikey. But anyway, worst broken airplane mess. I think that's two words.
Yeah, but we got the
worst airplane broken mess.
Yeah.
I guess on one of the episodes here on season one, we got around Christmas time, we got a C-46 stuck in Norman Wells for 8 days for a mix of an engine change / weather delay. Now, if you are the reason why people are eating and your airplane is stuck in their hometown, waiting for an engine, you get some very colorful phone calls. That's something that relates to the show that you guys could see.
That's great. That's good. Okay. I can go next. One word. Rampy.
Rampy? I guess the show kind of makes it look like slave labor.
It does, kind of. Those guys, they put... Now, explain to our listeners what that means.
Well, an airline, most airlines in this way... hire young pilots. Now, this is a weird thing. These guys spend anywhere from $30,000 to up to $90,000 if they wanted to get an aviation degree to become what they think is a pilot. But that's basically just a piece of paper and 250 hours or so. But to do the next step, they really got to build their hours up. And the magic number, I believe, is around 2,000 where they can start getting into the airlines. To do that, there's a whole bunch of different ways, but the real shortcut way to do it is basically to give up 2 years of your life, find an airline similar to Buffalo, and really, really work your tail off, you know, long hours and no money, and get a chance to fly these airplanes. The reason why you really, really put these guys through their paces is because, you know, a checkout on a DC-3 can operate, it can go around $20,000 to $30,000. And so you can't just, you know, hire a kid from a resume and invest $30,000 to him and then put him to work. You really got to see if he can handle it. So really it's basically boot camp. It's basically like a military boot camp where if they can hack it, then Buffalo Airways will invest the time and money and let them fly around in vintage airplanes.
That's great. So you must have some rampies who just can't cut it.
Oh yeah. Oh geez. 90% of them.
That's quite a fallout rate. My gosh.
Oh yeah. No, this thing, like check the show. Like it's a lot of them start off with really good intentions.
Oh sure. Yeah.
But they just can't do it. Like, why would you want to be outside at 40 below at 4 o'clock in the morning, work your tail off? The boss comes in 5 hours later and yells at you for something ridiculous.
Yeah.
It really wears a person down. But on the flip side, if you got the right mentality, the whole hangar's yours.
Yeah.
If you can just survive, like we have AJ DeCoste and Justin Simile, who are both former rampies. They're checked out on literally every single airplane. They can hop into an Electra, hop into a DC-3, hop into the DC-4, the C-46, the CL-215, and fly as much as they want. But they're literally one out of 100. To get to that point at Buffalo Airways, first of all, you want to, you know, look at Buffalo as more of a career than, you know, going to a major airline like Air Canada or WestJet, which are the two ones here in Canada. So you go through at least 100 guys to find one guy that says, hey, you know what? I don't really care. I'm the 1% of the people that don't really care. I want to fly a C-46 for the rest of my life. And it's just the adventure. They don't want to give it up.
That's cool. Dan, did you come up with a word for Mikey?
Let's go with water bomber.
Water bomber? Water bomber means summertime. That's where I got my mechanical background is working on DC-4s and CL-215s. And it's summer, you know, it's nice. It's really where I don't want to call it a cash cow, but it is the relatively best part for Buffalo Airways to gain revenue, for us to be very eccentric with other aircraft. You know, the same guys that are pushing pallets of, potato chips in the winter get to spend summer on a fire base waiting for a fire, and then they can go fight it with the DC-4, the CL-215, and then coming up next summer, not this summer, next summer, we're going to start using the Lockheed Electra.
Nice.
Very cool.
Yeah. You know, you talk about the water bombers. That made me remember the dam busters. Many episodes ago, I think now, David explained to us how the dam busters worked in World War II and that whole story, but you guys were recently involved in kind of a recreation of that, isn't that right?
Yeah, it's a kind of a funny story there. I think it's going to be airing, sorry for my Nat Geo friends, but I believe it's going to be airing on Nova sometime in the summer. Mm-hmm. And what happened was I get a call from a company in the UK called Windfall Films, and this really guy named Ian and Tom. Basically said, we want to drop a spinning bomb from an airplane. Do you have any airplanes? And I said, yeah, airplanes aren't a problem. What's this spinning bomb thing?
Yeah.
And said, well, this is what we want to do. We want to build a fake dam and drop a spinning bomb from an airplane and see if we can recreate what they did, you know, 70 years ago. And I said, well, if they do it 70 years ago, I'm pretty sure we could figure out how to do it now. It just went from there. And then they went to sell the idea, they went to the vice president of History Television here in Canada, and he basically told them straight up, if you don't use Buffalo, I'm not buying it, because I believe they can do it.
Wow.
So
yeah,
they called us up and I said, I guess we're using you guys. And I said, well, sure, we'll figure it out. So we, rigged up a DC-4 with the whole contraption. You know, we got Hugh Hunt, which was like the most brilliant man I've ever met, a Cambridge University professor. And we dropped a spinning bomb. And to see what happens, you're going to have to check your local listens there and watch the documentary.
All right, we won't spoil it.
Yeah, no, it's pretty, like, I've been privy to different versions because of different things, and it really gives me goosebumps. I can't believe we did it. But the tie-in is on a future episode of Ice Pilots, they do the Ice Pilots version, basically the behind-the-scenes of the documentary, which is kind of cool because, you know, in the show, the real thing of the show that I like is the camera guys, right? And that's kind of like the stuff, you know, with the Facebook and the Twitter. You can see behind the scenes, which is really cool. And this one episode that will come up about dam busting on Ice Pilots, you really get to see behind the scenes because you're following a film crew filming us.
Oh, that sounds great.
And all the problems. And, you know, you got the producer of the documentary literally pulling his hair out because at least 10 times we were at the point where we thought we were going to have to cancel it. And, we just kept on pushing it through, like, and it was no money. We basically did it for free just because it was such a fun idea.
Yeah. Wow. Well, Mikey, it sounds like you're really enjoying life.
Oh, yeah, it's fun. And like I was saying before, Buffalo Airways is a very lifestyle place. Like, sure, there is, you know, it's the 80-20 rule, you know, 80% of stuff is normal and 20% gives you the problems. You know, it's an old, economics thing, but really the 20% people at Buffalo really, really live Buffalo Airways. And then the 80% are the turnover people and all that stuff. But the people that are here, it is a lifestyle. Like there's a lot of us have Buffalo Airways tattoos, which, just shows like the dedication of it's no longer a job. It's a complete lifestyle. You know, when people leave and they quit, just like a family, you get in a family fight or whatever, and you say, I'm leaving or whatever, you eventually come back because the thing that's there and what I hope is caught on television is that, like, I want the people to say, why are they doing it? Hmm. And then by the end of it go, dang, man, I wish I could go up and try it out at least.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, just to catch the passion of why we're doing it because, like, sometimes I have no freaking clue. I'm jumping on a plane. I'm going to go down to, you know, Texas and work on a ranch or something.
Yeah.
Because it'd be nice. But I don't know. Everything else kind of starts being boring. You know, where vacations aren't vacations because you're just worried about work.
Mm-hmm.
And then, now that sounds like workaholics, but we're not really workaholics. We just live at work. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes a lot of sense. And I think you guys are really onto something.
Hey, I've got one last question because I know we're running out of time. But Mike, are you married? Did we already talk about that?
No, I'm single.
How are you ever gonna meet anybody up there?
No, I do okay. The television show definitely helps out in that regard.
Well, that's actually what I was going to ask you too. So has this brought a wealth of, you know, love letters and women saying we'd like to come up and live in Canada and marry you and
Dan, are you
taking notes?
See Mikey, what you need to understand is we have Dan here who needs help. So any advice you can give him, I don't know if he's going to be able to pull off starting his own television show yet, but any advice you can give him, he will be greatly appreciative.
Okay, so you're just telling me I need to move to an inaccessible part of the world and get my own reality show while running a successful airline.
That's it. That's it. Simple, Dan.
That sounds easy.
Yeah.
Or you could just make a deal with Mikey and have him, you know, send some of his, you know, cast-offs.
I don't know. The easiest, just get some warm clothes and come up and work, and we'll probably get you on TV.
That sounds great.
Well, wouldn't that be a gas? I mean, a week up there and I would probably be burned out.
But it would be fun.
Oh, no, it's fun. And we get a lot of people. Like, I was just entertaining two guys that flew in all the way from Toronto. And basically, they just said, can we just stand in the hangar and watch you guys? And I said, yeah, like for sure. Like when this television show is all over and the final camera guy packs up his tapes and leaves town, we're not going to change. Like we're exactly the same on before the television show. And, you know, in 40 years, my children are going to be doing the exact same thing. And I think hopefully that can come across on film, too.
Very good.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, Mikey, thanks so much for joining us. We really appreciate you taking the time. I know you're busy, and it's been a fantastic conversation. And we'll look forward to the upcoming episodes of Ice Pilots. We'll put links to the website in the show notes so people can find that easily. And Mikey, thanks for coming.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. You guys got some really good answers out of me too. You know, sometimes they want you to, you know, answer things certain ways, but you got some really good answers. So congrats to you guys.
We're like the reality podcast, maybe.
Yeah, for sure. And we just want to be realistic and honest with all our viewers and everything like that, because, you know, there's a lot of fake stuff out there right now. So we just want to be. We want to be different.
That's the way to do it. Just be honest. Wow.
It's such a cool show. It really is. And boy, for those folks that are listening to us, that if you haven't watched this, at least go up on the net and you can find the back shows from the first season. And I mean, they are really cool. They really are.
Yeah, this is definitely something worth checking out. So that's Ice Pilots. And Mikey McBrien, thanks again.
Well, thanks again for having me. And hopefully you can get me back sometime.
We'd love to have you back.
Oh, absolutely.
That'd be fun.
Please.
Well, maybe when I turn all Charlie Sheena, she can have my first black interview.
Oh, I can't. Oh, that'd be funny. And now, with his This Week in Aviation, here's David Vanderhoof, our official Airplane Geeks historian.
Thanks, Max. Welcome to This Week in Aviation, Volume 3, Episode 14, May 8th through the 14th. May 8th, 1911. The United States Navy orders its first airplane, the Curtiss Model D. This was the same aircraft Eugene Ely used to make the first takeoff and landing on a ship. The Curtiss Model D was a canard pusher aircraft. The Model D used ailerons instead of wing warping, patented by the Wright brothers. It had a V8 engine developing 60 horsepower. It had an endurance of 2.5 hours and could cruise at a whopping 50 miles an hour. So, happy birthday, the United States Navy Aviation Service, which is why we are celebrating the 100 years of centennial of naval aviation.
Right.
8 years later, May 8th. The United States Navy plans to fly across the Atlantic. Three Curtiss NC floatplanes are launched from New York, then Naval Air Station Rockaway, New York. The Curtiss floatplanes were named NC-1, NC-3, NC-4. No, I didn't miscount. NC-2 was cannibalized to support the other three aircraft. The first part of the flight was up the east coast of Newfoundland and was supported by eight Navy warships acting as waypoints. After reaching Newfoundland, on May 15th, the aircraft were dispatched to the Azores. Again, 22 more ships were stationed at 50-mile intervals to act as navigation aids and beacons. To assist the three aircraft, the searchlights were shown, and sailors would fire star shells into the sky, acting as kind of runway lights for them to fly their mission. During the second leg of the journey, NC-1 and NC-3 had to land. NC-1 was severely damaged and rescued by a Greek merchant ship. It unfortunately sunk while being towed. NC-3 actually taxied under its own power to the Azores, assisted by a United States Navy destroyer. On May 18th, NC-4 landed in the Azores and then went on to Portugal, making it the first ever aircraft to cross an ocean. NC-4 still exists and is the property of the Smithsonian Institution, but can be seen at the National Museum of Naval Aviation in Pensacola, Florida. Sticking with our Navy theme this week, May 9th, 1912, HMS Hibernia steams ahead at 10.5 knots while Commander Charles Sampson takes the Royal Naval Air Service Aircraft No. 2 down a makeshift runway off the bow of the battlecruiser and takes to the skies. He becomes the first person to launch from a moving ship. We talked about Eugene Ely earlier, and he took off and landed from a fixed anchored ship. The S-38 was a militarized version of the Schwartz S-27. The event took place in Weymouth Bay during fleet review. The launch was witnessed by His Royal Highness King George V. The S-38 had flotation bags and landed next to Hibernia to be hoisted aboard to repeat the process. May 11, 1903. Richard Pierce again. Allegedly, reportedly, supposedly took off in his machine next to the Olafai River in New Zealand and was able to cross a 30-foot riverbank. He continued another 1,000 yards before his engine overheated and he crashed to the ground. Grant you, all this occurred 6 months before the Wrights proved that man could fly on December 13, 1903. Pierce's flight would have made such a good picture, but it didn't happen. On May 14, 1908, Charles Furness becomes the first passenger in North America to fly. The flight piloted by Orville Wright in a Wright B biplane was for 2.5 miles, lasting a little over 4 minutes. Earlier in the day, he flew with Wilbur a little over 2,000 feet and in a flight lasting 29 seconds. Furness, who was a mechanic for the Wrights, was one of only a few people ever to fly with both brothers. They even took pictures to prove the event.
They were smart.
And now we go on to first flights. The Douglas DC-2, May 11th, 1934. Without it, there would be no Buffalo Airways and their DC-3s. Something you might not see in Buffalo Airways, a Learjet 31, first flew on May 11th, 1987. And last but not least, on May 13th, 1940, the Bell FL-1 Aerobonita. Now, if anyone knows what an Aerobonita is, I will do something. I don't know what. But if you know what a P-39 Aero Cobra was, the Aerobonita was a tailwheel standard gear with an arrestor hook designed to fly off of aircraft carriers. It was a naval version of the P-39 Aero Cobra. And that's the way it was, May 8th through the 14th. This is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off. And if anybody is going to be in the Tidewater, Virginia area on Friday and Saturday of next week, I will be down at Langley's Air Power over Hampton Road watching all the F-22s go by.
Oh, cool.
So somebody stop by. And if you see me, stop by, say hello, and hopefully I'll get some good interviews for the show.
What date is that? May what?
It would be Friday, May 13th, and Saturday, May 14th.
All right, great. Thank you, David.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, May 8th, 2011.
Well, g'day folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 146 of the Airplane Geek Show. I'm Steve Vischer, with me is Grant McHaren. Grant, you been up to much this week, mate?
Not a huge amount, mate, not a huge amount. Took a balloon out to the coast of Warrnambool and flew it over the city as part of a big sponsorship thing we're doing, and that was fun.
Yeah, not much else going on this week. Was there anything going on in the airline world this week?
You know, I think, didn't Virgin Who finally settle the deal?
You're spot on, my friend. I think that's about the major news we should cover airline-wise, at least this week. We have a new airline of sorts in this country.
Well, it's the same airline. It's just different name.
Oh, let me have my moment of fun.
Oh, okay, okay. So Virgin Blue has decided to change its name to Virgin Australia, thanks to some very serious negotiations between Branson and Singapore Airlines, who are blocking the use of Virgin on any other international airline, thus V Australia, and Pacific Blue. So it looks like Virgin Blue definitely now, and later V Australia, and then Pacific Blue will all rebrand under Virgin Australia.
Now, I sort of said during the week on Twitter that I should have put money on that, but just having a bit of a rethink, I actually had my money on Virgin Pacific. I wonder why they didn't go with that, considering predominantly that's what they'll be doing.
You've got Virgin Atlantic, but then you've got Virgin America, and then you've got Virgin Australia. So if you go with Virgin Pacific, well, you know, that's, I don't know, I think that's probably limiting it. Who knows, buddy?
Anyway, but I'll tell you what the interesting thing that struck me is the aircraft, as the new livery was slowly revealed this week through the media and through the new media sphere. It looks remarkably similar to Qantas, doesn't it? Red, white.
Yes. Well, you've got the silver lowercase writing of Virgin Australia at the front of the aircraft. You have the red band around the engines, and then you have the word Virgin up the tail, similar to the Virgin Atlantic style, I believe. That's led to a lot of people calling it Virgin Bland.
Interesting they're saying that. It does look perhaps a little bland on the outside, but, you know, let's face it, it's really what's on the inside of the aircraft that counts. And just having a look through the some of the pictures they've shown of the A330 that's been remodeled, and, of course, the 737 that's been redone, all leather interior, new ambient lighting as per the 787 theme that we see coming in line with a lot of Boeing products these days. The other thing too is, Grant, that the cabin staff have all got new uniforms to wear, so it's been a total rebranding all around of Virgin here in Australia. And you know, I think it's a bit unfair at this early stage to call them Virgin Bland. Let's see how the new product stacks up.
Yeah, no, it's going to be great to watch it put itself together. They are firmly establishing themselves into the middle area, something Virgin Blue was accused of occupying by default. Well, they're pushing through. They're going to get some people from business class, then use that business class for extra margin to help fund a total quality approach to business, economy, and discount economy. So, yeah, let's see how they go.
As we said in recent weeks too, there was a news of a big push at Virgin to go after the business market. Now, currently, according to some stats we've seen, Qantas currently carries about 90% of that market here in Australia, and Virgin makes up about the other 10%. So John Borghetti, their CEO, is saying they want to up that to somewhere in the realm of about 25% of the business market. Now, of course, they're going to be running these A330s from the East Coast across to Perth. And interestingly, Grant, Qantas has moved to counter that by putting extra capacity on their routes, and they've started running 747s across to Perth from the East Coast. Well, here's what Richard Branson had to say about that this week on CNBC.
Look, of course, Qantas will compete. They'll use, you know, every method they can to compete. Putting a 747 on Perth is, you know, they lost a fortune when they had a 747 on Perth before. So, you know, I doubt they'll keep it on, you know, for that much time. But we just got to be better than them, and we will be better than them.
That's a big call by Richard Branson. I would make the point, though, that the last time they were operating 747s on that route, that was probably, what, Grant, about 10 years ago when Ansett went down. And that was done out of necessity because of all of a sudden, 50% of the capacity across that route was lost when Ansett died. So, you know, those were different times, and things have changed a lot since then.
Well, that was also post 9/11 when they had these 747s that weren't able to fly internationally. And then when the routes did open up again, they were pretty low in terms of passenger numbers because everyone was scared to fly. So they had these 747s that weren't really being used to do much. So they took their 74s and 76s off the international, pumped them into the domestic, and away they went. Now, that was the big thing for Qantas when Ansett went under. They were able to pick up the extra capacity.
And in my experience, and having travelled across to Perth a couple of times in the last couple of years, I mean, those flights are very, very full going, you know, it doesn't seem to matter which airline you fly on. Those flights are quite full. And, of course, across in the west there where the big mining boom is going on at the moment, I mean, you know, that probably makes sense that there are a lot of extra people coming in. For instance, in the railways, the way some of the drivers there, they're earning such good money up there driving the iron ore trains around the west, they can afford to basically work up there for 2 weeks and fly back to their family on the east coast. And there's a lot of that sort of stuff going on, so adding extra capacity to that route, whether or not Virgin had chosen to go the way they've gone, is going to be a welcome move
indeed. And if it helps bring down the prices of getting from one side of the country to the other, which is a 5 or 6 hour flight equivalent of going from Boston across to San Francisco, then more capacity, more demand, lower fares, that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, now another interesting thing that Richard Branson talked about while he was over here, Grant, was how pleased he was with the appointment of John Borghetti to the top job there at Virgin. Well, I've got to stop saying Virgin Blue, Grant, Virgin Australia now.
And of course, Virgin Blue?
Yeah,
oh, sorry.
Absolutely. And, you know, he's made the point there that some of the moves that Virgin is making now, if they'd made them back in the time when Borghetti was working at Qantas, he would have been quite unimpressed looking at what's going on. But now that he's working for Virgin, he's very pleased that he's brought that experience across.
Yeah, well, this is his chance to show how he could have done things at Qantas if he had been given the gig. But I bet you Tiger wish they had a few more people who could push things pretty well, because they're suffering at the moment. They're trying to recruit new oversight staff in areas of quality control, logistics, maintenance control, safety and operations staff to perform the functions previously handled in Singapore.
Well, that's a very positive thing, Grant, and you've heard me bag Tiger Airways mercilessly over the time we've been doing this. Because of the failings that they have in that customer service department primarily. So I actually think that's a good thing. There's a quote here from Crawford Ricks, their CEO, saying that our new customer online support portal will be a vast improvement for customers as they can now submit their inquiries using the Tiger Airways website rather than sending a letter or a fax. Well, absolutely, and nice to see they're actually moving into at least the 20th century now when it comes to customer service, Grant. Fax?
Yeah, well, don't forget, mate, it's easier to redirect a mailing address to the dev null, aka the garbage bin, rather than having to take all those faxes that come in and delete them as well. Oh, sorry, was that me being nasty?
Actually, Grant, but, actually, I should now resubmit the complaint that I made back in November 2009.
Never hold back with a Dutchman with a grudge.
Absolutely.
But hey, no, it is good. Look, it is good. Tiger are trying to get those quality control operations in-house. They have to because of the show cause notice they got given by CASA. And they really want to make this happen because until they've addressed everything in the show cause notice, they're not going to be able to add additional aircraft to their air operators charter. And in fact, the recently delivered Airbus A320 is currently not able to be used. Oops.
Anyway, mate, was there any other interesting stuff that happened this week? Oh, I don't know. No, I had a pretty quiet week.
I think that was it. I think that was it. That was the big stuff, really.
Hey, what's that sound?
That sound.
Oh, hey. Oh, that jogs the memory. Hey, have a listen to that sound.
Hey.
Okay.
Okay.
Wow, that sounds like an L-39 leading Russian training jet.
Steve, you promised you weren't going to rub it in anymore.
Woohoo! I promised, but I lied. Yes, folks, I went for a ride in a fighter jet this week. Wow, what an experience.
No, Visha, just because you got a ride in a jet and I'm still like, mate, I pulled 8 Gs. I did sustained 8 Gs. You haven't beaten that. Just because you got a jet, don't, no, Steve, don't hit play. Steve.
I should change my name to Steve Tupper. I think that's already been done, though. Let's have a listen.
Don't, oh.
Traffic in the Oscar Tango is rolling. Good speed. Here we go. Okay, so the first thing we do, we go for height. We're above 3,000. A nice gentle roll, just to get used to it. Wow. We'll get you another one up to the right. Big barrel roll, up we go. What about 2G there? Okay, we'll do a G-turn. What a G-turn does, warms you up to the idea of a bit of a G-force, okay?
Okay.
All right, we do that for you. Get ready to tense up. You ready?
Yep, ready.
Okay, a bit of G coming on. 2G there. How do you feel?
That's quite
a... All right, here comes 4. That's 4G there.
Boy, that's heavy.
You can certainly tell the difference, can't you?
Oh, yeah. Gee whiz.
Up we go. We climb up, get a bit of height. Up for your slingshot mission. We'll go down for a loop. But remember, at the bottom of the loop, you've got to tense up. Okay?
Roger.
Okay, looking around for traffic. Here we go, tense up. Okay, looking backwards, here comes the ground. Upside down, there's no G on there.
Yeah, it really compresses you.
Yeah, it does. Okay, a little bit of G coming on, put a bit more power on. Okay, vertical roll, you ready? Up we go. Straight up. Looking out to the left. Are we going vertical? Yes or no? Yes, we are. Rolling round.
All right.
Upside down.
Africa, Mike, you send.
Well, wasn't that awesome? I tell you what, I feel, I do feel a bit Steve Tupper-like now. In fact, I did take some... Grant, are you there? Grant? Grant? Hello, Grant? Is this thing on? Where are you, Grant?
Here are you, hippie. I'm out of here.
Come on, buddy. Who's going to play Goose in the movie?
Goose? Goose? You're making it bloody worse, Visha.
Oh, come on, buddy. Come back. You can have the next ride.
No, it's too late for that, Visha.
Oh, dear. Well, folks, hopefully we'll be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Visha. That was Grant McHerron. Cheers, folks. Woo! Just as dead.
Oh, man. I'm so envious.
Okay.
Oh, man. That sounds like... Did you watch the video of the...
No, not yet.
Back in? I mean, it was... Sounds like he had a good time.
Yeah, but in all fairness, Steve, it ain't Russian. It's Czechoslovakian. So don't call an L-39 Albatross a Russian, even though they flew in the Soviet Air Force. It ain't Russian. It's Czechoslovakian.
Wow.
So get it straight.
Either way, I always wanted to be Richard Branson, because I always wanted hair like that. But Now I want to be Steve Vischer.
Yeah, but then if you're Steve Vischer, who would Steve Vischer be?
So Vischer's got the L-29. I went flying with the Golden Knight. And Rob goes jetting around in A380s. I think, Dan, you try to pick up chicks on flights from San Francisco to Toronto on Virgin. So, Max, you really...
That's an inaccurate retelling of the story.
I mean, Max, it's your turn. You got to go do something, dude.
My biggest excitement was an aerobatic glider. Maybe not as exciting as a jet trainer, but that was pretty good. Yeah, you can pull quite a few G's in a glider if you really want to.
Yeah, but I bet if you wanted to, you could at your employer, your regular job, watch them throw chickens into the motors,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that's a good way to take out some aggression.
I can't do that.
Well, a couple weeks ago, I flew an X-15 on X-Plane for iPad. So I'm just so far ahead of you guys.
That's great. Here's Peter Johnson across the pond.
Today, I'm joined by Peter Boinovich. Peter is author of the Tango 6 blog, a pilot, and a journalist for the Serbian Military Aviation magazine. Peter, welcome to Across the Pond.
Hi, Peter. Nice to be here.
Peter, can you just start by telling us a little bit about aviation history of Serbia?
Serbia's aviation is quite interesting because we have a really formidable history. I don't know if you knew that Serbia was one of the first countries that had an air force globally.
No, I didn't know that.
We were the fifth oldest air force in the world. We had a second aerial combat victim in the world. The first one was also from these parts of Europe, a Bulgarian. Serbia was number two. Serbia got its wings, let's say, in 1909. That is the year that we basically had the first glider flight.
Right.
Serbia's Air Force is number five in history. We established it in 1912.
Right.
Then we had like a very respectable aviation industry heritage. We established the aviation industry like a strategic decision in those days. It began like in 1920 when as many as seven companies started the production of aircraft engines and related equipment.
Can you just tell us a little bit about the infrastructure of the of aviation in the country? I mean, the main airports, I think, is it Nikola Tesla?
Yeah. Because there are two international airports in Serbia. First one is Belgrade, and the second one is Niš in the south of Serbia.
Right. So, and what sort of destinations do they serve?
Yat Airways of Serbia is the successor of the old Yat that was once very, very large airline for this part of Europe. But when it ended, the national airline transformed to a much smaller airline, and currently it serves something like 38 or 39 cities. And its fleet is naturally quite reduced from the old. The old yacht was quite a large fleet because we had like 707, 727, 737s at one point.
I remember seeing all of those types at coming into Heathrow, actually.
Yeah, yeah. These days, unfortunately, it's reduced only to three types officially, the ATR 72-200, the Boeing 737-300 as its largest number the type, and the 737-200 advanced from Aviogenics, the charter airline.
Peter, what is general aviation like in Serbia?
Basically, it's divided between two generations of general aviation. We have the Cessnas, the 60s and 70s types of planes, and that generation is slowly giving away to more contemporary ultralight, let's call them plastic aircraft, but very affordable, very simpler to operate, and they are pretty much dominating the current general privately owned aviation fleet because they are, at the end of the day, more cheaper to operate pretty much joyrides, and it's the ultralight newer generation types that are more effective and desirable for operation.
And so, Peter, tell us a little bit about Serbian military aviation.
Yeah, well, Serbia's Air Force is, like I like to say, a pretty formidable Air Force during its entire history, because we had some really interesting types, predominantly because of the politics that were involved during former Yugoslavia and in the recent years, because we were flying Sabres at one time. When we again transferred politically to Eastern Europe, we received the MiG-21s, MiG-29s, and of course we had a very formidable local manufacturing. There we produced aircraft like the J-22, the J-22 Eagle ground attack aircraft. We also produced the famous G-4 Super Galop. The J-21 Yastreb was in the news recently because it was shot down on the airfield in Libya. It was recently in the news. So basically, Russian equipment for frontline use, domestic equipment for a ground attack role, and basically that's it.
Yeah. And Peter, what helicopters are operating for the Serbian military forces?
French Aerospatiale Gazelle helicopters manufactured locally and for general purpose transport. We have the Mi-8 helicopters, two Mi-24s, but they were never employed officially by the Air Force.
Peter, I think you've got a very interesting museum.
The Yugoslav Aviation Museum, it has a very interesting collection that has over 200 aircraft from various European and American countries, also domestic ones. It's a very nice place to see various equipment from all over the world, famous World War II airplanes like the Messerschmitts 109s, Hurricane Mark II, Spitfire Mark VII, Yak III, Ilyushin Il-2. And they're all in ex-Yugoslavian rondels because we had them all during some points in our history. Also a Thunderbolt P-47. The most interesting example is the Fiat G-50 Swiss, an Italian fighter from the beginning of the World War II. It is the only saved specimen in the world. Outside, you can find the Caravelle, the SE-210, Junkers U-52, Ilyushin Il-14, Douglas DC-3. And for the Brits, we have the short silent Mark I and the DHC-2 Beaver. So it's a pretty interesting aviation museum. It's a pretty interesting place to visit if you're in Belgrade.
It's been very useful talking to you and understanding a little bit more about aviation in Serbia. And Petr, where can our listeners find you online?
You can find me at www.tango6blog/English, all kinds of aviation analysis and news. And you can find me at Twitter at Tango6.
Excellent. Petr, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Peter.
Just to confirm, Petr's blog is www.tango6blog.com/English. You can find me at Mascot Hornet on Twitter and at alphatangopapa.blogspot.com. This is Peter Johnson, reporting for the Airplane Geeks from across the pond.
Yeah, I was just listening to Peter's voice. Can you imagine Peter ever being mad?
He sounds pretty even-tempered, doesn't he?
Yeah, Peter, we need to hear something. Part of your part of your initiation into the Airplane Geeks is a clip when you lose your mind. Yeah. We all have some of those. So we need that.
I don't think any of us have really gotten mad on the show.
No.
Maybe gone mad, but not.
Yes,
not
yeah,
mad.
That's right.
Okay.
That blog is tango6blog.com is tango6blog.com/English. Okay, on to some listener mail.
Pretty light this week. I was disappointed.
Oh, yeah. Well, there were a few more that came in just in the last few days, but I've been kind of offline a lot lately. So if you did send yours in kind of recently, we'll have to wait until next episode. We got an email from David. David says, I write this on Tuesday morning, May 3rd. How has the post-Osama airport experience changed? Here are my first impressions. David says, I'm flying Delta this morning out of Philadelphia. I noticed more police parked along the roadway near curbside drop-off. Going through the security checkpoint was quick, but I was flagged for a random extra screening. I don't recall those glass boxes just beyond the walkthrough metal detectors being used as much as this morning. Inside the terminal, I see a bit more security walking the hallways. As I wait for my flight, I have a window seat, and looking out over the field, I see an increase in cars and trucks driving around the field. My impression of the vehicle traffic is increased security patrolling the far corners of the field. Overall, travel is easy, and the latest world events haven't impacted me very much. However, I get the sense of a real increase in security buzz in the background. Thanks for the great podcast. So, does anyone think that airport security is going to change significantly?
This David also flew Delta from PHL on Monday.
Yeah, well, that's right.
On Tuesday, I had one of the most disappointing things I've ever had in my life. I was flying with three of my coworkers. All three of them had full body scans and secondary screening, and I didn't. And I really wanted to go through the secondary screener, the full body scanner. But
you were the first person I've ever said, "Wow, I really wanted to go through a body scanner."
But David felt left out.
Well, how often do I get to fly? The other thing that I actually did this time was I used the Delta app on my new iPhone, and my boarding pass was a 2D barcode on my phone, which was pretty awesome. So Delta did really cool about, you know, you type in your code and it downloads into your phone and you just wave it over the TSA scanner and you wave it over the scanner to board the airplane. So I was very impressed with the Delta app. And I had my first Biscoffs. So
after, welcome to the club.
After and almost 40 years from my last Delta flight.
Did you do the trick for the Biscoff?
There's a trick. I just got told to eat Biscoffs. I didn't get.
Well, you get a Biscoff, but if you get like a lime wedge and you squeeze the lime wedge over the Biscoff, it's a poor man's key lime pie.
Hmm.
I'm not making this up.
We'll have to try that.
No, I'm sorry, Dan. I actually had alcohol. I didn't just ask for a lime wedge.
I actually have a whole sleeve of Biscoffs at home that I need to get going on.
David wrote in again. I've done an East Coast trip in a 757 three times in the last year, and every time I have been very impressed with takeoff acceleration and what feels like aggressive climb-out capabilities. My frame of reference is that I usually fly A319s, A320s, or 737s, each of which lumber into the air confidently, but they take their time getting the job done. David goes on, all of my impressive 757 rides have been with cabins about one half full, so there is less weight in terms of meat or people. I'm guessing the real performance I'm feeling comes from the small amount of fuel we must have had on board for an 800-mile flight. The 757 Wikipedia page says 757 can have a max range of up to 3,900 miles. Do you guys agree with my intuition that the 757 is relatively light on these short flights related to the power hanging under the wings and those large engines? Can you think of anything else at play here, giving me the feeling of a big power difference between a 757 and a 737 class aircraft?
Okay, first of all, folks, if you are not a real geek, having heard some of this stuff before on our pre-show, you need to turn it off now because we are going to deep, dark geekdom between Dan and Max. Take it away, guys.
Well, I would say before we get into any numbers, it's actually kind of hard to answer this question because obviously, as David mentioned, it was on a short flight, so it varies exactly what kind of load it is. But also, in terms of something like the thrust to weight ratio, or as I think Max did it, weight to thrust, one of the issues is For a 757, for example, there are a couple. If you go through the Boeing airport planning documents posted on their website, there are a few different versions of the 757 in terms of max takeoff weight. But also on the 757, you have Pratt & Whitney engines or Rolls-Royce engines. And within that series, you have a couple different variants that have different thrust ratings. So it's sometimes a bit hard to compare, but Max did more of the numbers. So I'm going to be quiet now.
Well, it is kind of a little tricky to do some calculations, but we looked at the maximum takeoff weight for the 757-200 has got a maximum takeoff weight, I believe, of 255,000 pounds. Thrust depends on the engine and the variant, but it can run anywhere from about just under 37,000 pounds of thrust per engine all the way up to 43,500. And when you look at that, if you go thrust to weight, you get numbers ranging from, around 0.3, from a little under 0.3 to a little over 0.3. Is that what you got, Dan?
Oh, well, you did weight to thrust, so I got rid of my thrust to weights and did it the other way around.
Well, the 0.3, here we go. The 0.3 is thrust to, I try to convert to your numbers.
When I did it my other way to weight to thrust, I got it like 3.18, I think.
You getting this, Rob? Because I got lost after the word 757.
Oh, no, sorry, not 3.1. I got 2.93 for the 757. What did you get?
I got between 0.29 to 0.34.
Yeah, I got a 0.34 the other way.
Yeah, 0.34 if you go maximum thrust, maximum weight. But when I do the same calculation for the 767-300, I get essentially the exact same number.
Right.
For the A330-300, I get a slightly smaller number, like around 0.25.
And then to what David was flying, I'm playing around with some numbers here for the 737-800 and the A320. I'm getting numbers in about the 0.31 range, 0.31, 0.32, depending on how you round for like the A320, 737. But again, it's kind of hard with all the different variants out there, but I would say compared to something like a 7.3 or an A320, I think it's fair to say the 7.5 has a little bit more power, relatively speaking. The 7.5 is an interesting aircraft. I was just thinking about this today, and Rob would know this because Rob has ATC experience. Am I remembering correctly that at least at some point in time, at least in the U.S., the 7.5 was referred to as a heavy by ATC?
Oh, absolutely. Well, actually, no, it didn't start out that way because, in fact, some of the early wake turbulence incidents really started to evolve. I mean, they knew it was going to happen in the 7.4, but they didn't realize the 757 was going to produce the kind of wake turbulence that it did. In fact, they lost a number of business jets behind 757s because the wing is very interesting on that airplane. I'm not the engineer you guys are, and David, for whatever it's worth, I have no idea what those two guys are just talking about.
But I'm not an engineer though. Disclaimer, I'm not an engineer, I'm a finance major.
But I do know people that fly that airplane, and they say it just climbs like a bat out of hell. I mean, so whether it's the engines and the wing or whatever, but most of the time the pilots feel like they've got to hold it down. But, of course, it's a lot smaller airplane than a 767 as well. Common type rating, believe it or not. But again, everybody I know just says that they love that airplane. Kind of like the old DC-8s. They used to do the same thing. If you watched a DC-8 on takeoff, it almost looked like they were trying to hold the nose down because it had such a high power to weight ratio that they would just climb like eagles.
My first flight was on a 7.5 back in the day. A little bit of Dan history there.
Oh. Well, so. I don't know what all the relevant variables are. For example, you mentioned the wing, Rob. I don't know if there's big differences in the lift of different aircraft. I mean, even with the same power and weight, does some airliners generate more lift and so would climb faster and give you the feeling that they have more power. I'm really totally out of my element on that.
Well, and that might have some, and again, I'm not an engineer. I'm sure we must have aeronautical engineers out here somewhere in our listening audience. So please send us an email, call into the hotline and give us the scoop on the 757, because my guess is that there's some connection between the fact that airplane climbs so well and the fact that it generates just horrendous wake turbulence behind it.
And basically we have no idea.
No, but we have no idea. But, you know, see, that's the difference between our show and some other shows. We admit we don't know anything about
what we're
this
talking
at
about.
All. Yes, exactly.
All right, well, David came through yet again, and I'm pretty sure it's
except
the same
David. David knows what he's talking
our
about.
David does.
Yes.
Yes. Other David says, hi, geeks. I flew home on an A320 last night, and as usual, I was loving United's policy at the pilot's discretion of sharing ATC audio over Channel 9. David says, United has been running a Microsoft Zune commercial on top of Channel 9 during takeoff and climbout. Last night was different, so I heard the tower telling each of us to, quote, line up and wait. David says, where is my position and hold?
Gone!
Did they
Gone.
Change that?
Gone, yes, they changed that last year. That was to maintain some sort of commonality with ICAO, which is the International Civil Aviation Organization, the sort of the UN body that governs aviation up in Montreal. So line up and wait has replaced taxi into position and hold, and it's never coming back.
It seems like a sad day.
Yes, well, there are places that cannot even use line up and wait anymore because of some other things, but that's a whole controller training thing, so we won't. Don't even get me started on that.
Okay.
I sort of like how the way Rob put it, like he made it sound like a parent that was punishing you. Position and hold is gone, and it's never coming back.
It's funny.
Well, I do have some experience in that realm. You know,
and Dan, the follow-on statement was, but why? And Rob's comment was, because I said so.
I said so.
No. It would be. Wait for it. Because ICAO said so.
There we go. All right. I think that's it. Thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Mikey McBrien from Buffalo Airways and the TV show Ice Pilots NWT. You can find that website at www.icepilots.com. They're also on Twitter at @IcePilotsNWT. And be sure to check out that program. It's really some great TV. We'd like to thank Steve Fisher and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report. And also Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. All right, let's tell folks where they can find us online. David, we'll start with you.
I can be found on my blog at whatjustflewby.com, and you can find me on Twitter at @DMVanderhoof.
And Dan Webb?
You can find my blog at thingsinthesky.com, and you can also find me on Twitter at Dan Webbage.
Great. And Rob Mark, how about you?
Well, let's see. Wait, let me just check. Yes, we paid our bill for the server rental, so that means that they will find us at jetwine.com. And Twitter, of course, is free, so I guess we're always on Twitter at Jetwine.
And Rob,
Max, where can we find you? Oh,
wait a minute, hold it, Rob. We got to do one other thing. Where else can we find Jetwine?
Facebook, right. Oh, right. David spent a whole hour with me last week getting me Facebook qualified. And so Jetwine has a place on Facebook, and it's sort of evolving.
Good.
And the Airplane Geeks Facebook page is sort of my hero.
Aw.
Your role model.
Wait, let me check.
Role model, sorry. And the Facebook page on the Airplane Geeks Facebook page is kind of my, what is it?
Role model.
Role model.
By the way, it's kind of, I've kind of been checking the Facebook page obsessively lately because we're 4 people away from 500 Facebook fans.
Very good. So let's see if we can push over the top this next week.
And Max, where can they find you?
Finally, I'm Max Flight. You can find me at the 30,000feet.com aviation directory. And that's all in words, THIRTY, et cetera, et cetera. You can also find me on Twitter at Max Flight. You can find show notes for this episode, which was 146, at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll find links to the sites we mentioned in the podcast, also some listener comments, and you can even buy Airplane Geeks t-shirts. Be sure to follow Airplane Geeks on Twitter and Facebook. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream this podcast to your mobile phone. You can also send us email. That address is thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And we have a listener line where you can leave us your very own audio message.
I wonder what the number is.
Let's ask Benet Wilson.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Benet.
Opening... By the way,
yes.
Happy Mother's Day, Aunt Benet.
Yes.
We forgot to say that, didn't we?
Dan, good for you. Opening and closing music is by Brother Love. Find him at www.brotherloverocks.com. If you'd like to help us out, be sure to tell your friends about us. So join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everyone.
Good night. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Good day, or whatever time it is where you are.
Hey, good evening, everyone, and thank you, as always, for some reason, continuing to listen to us drone on for hours every week.
Yeah, drone. Oh,
wow, that was not positive at all. Let's do that again.
Okay. First story comes from Aviation Week, and the title has one of these dopey pop-up windows over it, so I can't read. Oh, there it goes. First, it's covering up the title of the story. I couldn't read what it was. We have an article from Air Transport World. It's the damn thing is opening up over the title again. It's a Porsche ad. How do I kill this ad? There we go. All right, there. God, it keeps opening. All right, any other news we want to talk about?
I'm eating a delicious cookie right now.
That's fascinating news.
Can we talk about Dan's dating life?
No.
That'd be a very brief news story.
Usually I'm a little bit more funnier, but I don't know. You guys got me some real questions. Usually I get like fluffy questions.
Fluffy questions. So guys, like what kind of fluffy questions do you get?
It's pretty cold up there. any creative ways to stay warm? You say, well, that's what groupies are for, or something like that.
Yes, but Mikey, you've got four people here who are airplane junkies. So yeah. I mean, the fact that I can turn on my television and watch some of my all-time favorite airplanes like DC-3s and C-46s, that's really cool.
Yeah, it definitely is.
It's pretty cool. And if you guys go on YouTube, there's a comedian here in Canada. His name's Rick Mercer. He's pretty funny. And he did. He came up and did a – he's a comedian, and he came and did a rampy for a day. So if you go on YouTube and just punch in Rick Mercer Ice Pilots – it's a 6-minute thing, and him and my dad jump in the DC-3, and they're flying over the ice road at 15 feet. And the guy's a non-pilot. He's a comedian sitting in the right-hand seat, and they're flying, and there's vehicles dodging out of the way. Like, this stuff's freaking crazy.
Yeah, I
saw the footage when they came back, and I'm like, okay, we're shut down. Yeah, so it's pretty cool. And it just reminded me, because I got a picture here on my laptop here that's reminding me never to let my dad fly with a comedian.
Is this a cue for a soundbite?
No.
Oh, okay.
I did have another soundbite, but it's pretty crap, so don't worry about it.
Okay. So let's seg on to Tiger at the moment, and then that'll lead us on to yours.
Yep. So just make a little comment on that, and we'll segue.
Yeah, across. Yeah. It was. Well, you said he was. Now that he's doing it, he's very impressed, right?
Yep.
And what was he impressed about? Damn. What's he impressed about?
About the way he's running the company.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, it's always funny once you're... Well.
Come on, buddy. Who's going to play Goose in the movie?
Goose? You bastard, Vischer!
I think I'm going to have to bleep that.
Woo!
Woo! That's nice. No. Are you still recording?
Yeah.
You got to, what you got to do is go, yeehaw, Jess is dead. Go.
Yeah, I got it. We'll be back next week. I'm hoping I'm not sounding too smug here. Oh, well, I hope Grant will be back next week. Until then, I'm Steve Vischer. Woo, Jess is dead.
Well, we should wish Peter a belated happy birthday because we forgot last week.
Yeah, we've had a lot of birthdays and definitely don't want to leave Peter out. So happy belated birthday, Peter.
You guys are really old.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Peter. Happy birthday to you.
And many more.